athletes have always been front and center in endorsements and sponsorships, and the best athletes in the world generally commanded the most time, money, and attention from that. Where the evolution is happening is it's now cascading all the way down through your roster and bench and into your age group teams and really into young athletes who now, with name, image, and likeness rights, have the opportunity to commercialize themselves at a much younger age.
What keeps sport alive today? Well, it's not just ticket sales or sponsorships anymore, but make no mistake, money is at the center of it all. From sports betting and private equity to new sponsorship models and shifting consumer behavior, money is moving through Canadian sport in new ways and faster than many organizations can keep up with. New revenue is entering the system, but where it's going, who benefits, and who gets left behind is becoming a much bigger question. In the second episode of Sport Intelligence, The State of Sport in Canada, Dr. Anne Pagararo and I sit down again to take a deeper look at the forces reshaping how sport is funded, consumed, and sustained in Canada. Because as the business of sport changes, organizations are being pushed to rethink everything from partnerships and participation to athlete protection and long-term survival. You're also going to hear from Michael Bartlett, CEO of Canada Basketball, who shares what these pressures look like on the ground for national sport organizations. This is episode 2, brought to you by CERC in collaboration with the Gordon S. Lang School of Business and Economics at the University of Guelph. All right, Anne. So, episode 1 was all about the macro trends. This one is all about the money. So what do you see is changing the most dramatically on how money flows through sport nowadays?
I'd say that we've seen a huge influx of private equity money. So that investment's coming. We've seen a huge shift of money into women's sports, youth sports. And then I think probably more drastically, we're seeing how people spend their money differently in sports, particularly in Ontario and in Canada on sports betting. So money's flowing really differently than it did 5 years ago.
Yeah. And you just mentioned the one that I'm sure, again, we could talk about for hours, which is right. The sports betting, which has exploded in Canada. It's funny because living out here in BC, you don't see the ads as much. And then as soon as you go to a streaming system, it's like that's all they're pushing is online gambling and betting. So how significant is this shift for the sports system overall to see?
Yeah, I mean, it brings new people to sports. Bettors watch sport really differently, but it's also shifting money into different areas, right? And so there's opportunity for sport, but there's also, I think, a negative in terms of where people are putting their money. They're not buying tickets, they're spending it on trying to win. And so, yeah, I think that it's a really different way that consumers' dollars are being spent.
Well, and that's consumer dollars. So one of the tensions that you highlight is that revenue is going to governments, not necessarily back into sport. Why is that happening and why does that matter?
Right. So gaming organizations are taxed on the revenue, right? And that tax, I think in Ontario about 2 years ago, was over $1 billion of just tax on the revenue the gaming companies were making. And that goes into the government. That goes into split between about $700 million into Ontario and $300 million into the federals. So we know that they're making money off of sport and sport betting, but none of that money can be traced or any way that it's being reinvested into sport itself.
And whilst there's growing pressure to reinvest betting revenue back into sport, not everyone sees that as a straightforward solution. Here's Michael Bartlett.
Government is using that money for something already. You do run this risk of having a direct correlation between betting revenue and supporting sports, and us all of a sudden, without meaning to, having the feeling as a sport organization to promote more betting as a result of knowing that it will drive more incremental funding to our cause.
Okay, well, do you think anything will shift because of that?
The pressure is on in some ways. We've been talking about it pretty openly for the last year about this money that's being made off of sport. We know it must be supporting something else in the government. So it's not going into people's pockets. So it's probably propping up health or somewhere else. But I think being able to directly say people's money who gets the revenue that's coming from sport betting is actually supporting sports. There's a downside. I mean, you know, people might want to spend more money betting if they think it's going to support whether their kid gets a new soccer field or not. I think there's a downside, but the upside right now is we know the entire Canadian sports system needs revenue, needs an influx of cash and investment, and we know that money's being made off of those sports on a regular basis.
So then are we at risk of building a system that benefits from betting without actually protecting the people inside it?
Yeah. And we all think about the Super Bowl, right? Everybody bets on the Super Bowl, $700 million or whatever gets spent on. During the Winter Olympic Games, I decided to check out a site called Polymarket. Now, Polymarket's not legal in Canada, but it's a prediction market. It's like a yes, no, right? You can bet on all kinds of things. But in sport, I thought, okay, let's just see what's being bet on the Olympics. And I picked up a mixed biathlon race. So you would think nobody's betting on it, right? And live during the game, during the match where people were competing, the countries, the betting was going up and down. And I think I'd started and there had been maybe 30,000 and I was done. There was like $200,000 or $300,000 that had been bet on mixed biathlon. So those athletes are competing and people are trying to make money off of the sport they're in. And so we're definitely seeing, at least on the professional and now I'd say Olympic, Paralympic side of things, betting happening where athletes are competing. And we need to be really aware of what position those athletes are in. So some NSOs have told me that while their team is competing, they're constantly getting messages through their social media channels about take this player off, you need to win the next point. And so they're going through people who manage social media, but the athletes themselves are getting direct threats, right? Because people will bet a lot of money. And so I do think we need to think about, yes, we're profiting, or at least professional sports profiting from betting on it. If we start using that money in amateur sport, we need to really think about how we protect the athletes who are competing.
Yeah. Okay. So like the data on athlete abuse is tied to the betting. So what else has stood out to you the most?
Women athletes are more at risk.
Okay.
As we know, women athletes are more at risk for almost anything when they're in the media in terms of negative attention, and they're more at risk for, they get a lot more of the hate messages. At least some studies out of the United States have showed that with NCAA athletes. And I mean, organizations need to be ready to educate their athletes, to support them, and to hopefully look at blocking this type of messaging from their accounts.
Well, and it's a slippery slope, and I know we're going to talk about this as well, because athletes are utilizing their social media for themselves as well. So it's not like they can just cut it off, because first of all, I'd be going, well, you know, block these people, but it's also their way of funding and their way of getting themselves out there. And you mentioned a little bit right now, but how should sport organizations be thinking about athlete protection in this actual environment? I don't even know where you'd start.
So I think we see it at the elite level. So when the Olympics, Paralympics, World Championships are on, the organizing committees do hire firms to track this and to block it and geo-block it and do whatever they can. So at the elite level, I think there are definitely some tools that are being used, but that's certainly not happening at local club levels or provincial levels or anything inside Canada. So I think that we need to start looking at how can we support athletes? How can we educate them about what's going to happen? And you're right. They are usually under contract with sponsors, either national team athletes, athletes who participate in the NCAA and their name, image, and likeness are going to be contractually obligated to be on social media and posting. And at the same time, their direct message channels are producing a lot of harm. So I think we need to have education for them. We need to have support. And hopefully if your organization at sometimes can afford it, when you're putting on events that are going to attract a lot of betting, work with a company or someone that you can to try to block some of those messages coming at the athletes.
Is there anything anecdotally that you know about that as it relates to the differences between men and women getting the messages?
I mean, I think the NCAA has done some really good work on this around March Madness. It's a great sort of way to study it. We have two parallel tournaments happening at the same time, very similar formats. It's one and done or survive in advance. And so every game has got something on the line. And when they studied it that way, they found that a lot more of the harm was focused on the women athletes during March Madness than in the men. I should also say their study showed that it's not just limited to the athletes. Coaches and athletic administrators and managers were also feeling the heat from sport gamblers.
And at the same time athletes are navigating online abuse, they're also becoming brands themselves much earlier than ever before, as Michael points out.
Where the evolution is happening is it's now cascading all the way down through your roster and bench and into your age group teams and really into young basketball players, young athletes who now with name, image, and likeness rights have the opportunity to commercialize themselves at a much younger age, knowing that it used to be Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, and a handful of others. Now we've got age group kids in our program that haven't even hit university yet that are making a paycheck based on their name, image, and likeness. And that's a reality now, that those obligations that come with that paycheck from an endorsement deal also might counter with their time and availability to be part of the national team in the summer, because they have this obligation to said partner. As a player is going through university now and they're earning a meaningful wage at university, and frankly, I support that. I think NCAA has been monetizing on the rights of athletes for decades. I have no problem with athletes making their fair share of that compensation, but it does now create an opportunity that if their name, image, likeness contract says if they're injured in a context other than their NCAA context, you know, maybe part of their fee is voided. That's now a consideration for a player trying to figure out whether to play on the national team or not in the summer.
And so you've highlighted that financially vulnerable households are most impacted by betting. How does that intersect with sport participation?
Right. So we know that individuals see betting as a way out to make money and faster if they need it. And so the problem is, if you're not good at it, and that would be the majority of bettors, it takes away from disposable income in any house. So if you're thinking back to our conversation about less disposable income in houses in Canada right now in general, if you're taking that money and gambling and trying to get ahead financially that way, you now have really no money to spend on your child joining sport.
That financial pressure is something sport organizations are seeing firsthand, especially as costs rise and low-cost participation options disappear. I asked Michael where he sees it in basketball and what he found most concerning.
The rapid expansion of travel sport and the dilution of house league sport. Sport leagues have figured out that a parent will write the check for a travel program because their kid wants to play, or they want their kid to play, and they figure it out generally on how to afford it. And yet it's come at the expense of house league low to no fee basketball or low to no fee sport. When I was a kid growing up, there seemed to be one rep team for every age group, and then there was house league for everybody else. And there was 10 to 12 house league teams and one rep team. Now, in some markets, there's 10 to 12 rep teams for an age group and no house, because they've just created AAA, AA, single A, and then they're into BBB, double B, single B, and they just keep cascading down for as many athletes as they have interested, and they find a reason to call it an A, a B, or a C, or whatever. So I think it's eliminated house league, which is eliminated low-cost play, and that's a concern.
So if the traditional low-cost model of sport is disappearing in some communities, what responsibility do national sport organizations have to help offset that? Michael says it's something they're actively thinking about.
We have and will continue to expand opportunities for 13 and 14-year-olds to join Canada Basketball's Junior Academy, as we call it. We're starting to partner with provinces to be delivering junior academies in more than just one province now, too. So the best of that age group are brought in. There still is a fee element, but a lower fee element to it that gets these youth into the national system, learning the style of play, working with the coaches, and graduating over time into our age group teams and eventually the senior team. So you look at RJ Barrett, he's a product of Junior Academy. It was created in his 13, 14 year cohort, and he is now certainly a product of that continual development, even from that age. So that has to be on us to make sure that we're offering that in more places and provinces in this country at a low to no fee element, because those same players are playing with a club in their local town or in their region that is probably a pretty expensive club because it's a high performing, high talent club. So we've got to make sure that we balance the costs associated with age groups. We're trying to be one of the few team sports in this country that also doesn't charge its age group athletes to be on the national team. As budgets get more constrained, we have to have more and more conversation about whether we need to. But as of today, we've been able to avoid having to charge our age group athletes to be on the national team.
Needless to say, that balancing act is becoming a much bigger part of the conversation across sport right now. How do organizations grow participation, grow audiences, and grow revenue while still protecting access and protecting the people inside the system? Because as new money flows into sport, there are also new pressures and new risks emerging alongside it. In saying that, Anne, what are your thoughts on whether there's a contradiction between growing sport through betting engagement whilst also trying to protect communities from the harms connected to it?
we have not paid heed to what has happened, particularly in the UK, and how they are trying to get rid of betting in their society. And they've seen the harms, and particularly for young men. And we haven't heeded it. And we just brought it full force in to Canada. And I don't think we have the supports ready for these people. And I don't think we have a real plan to exit-ish now that we're starting to learn it's not the end all be all.
I agree. I think the support component, we always seem to be more reactive than proactive around things like that. And correct. I mean, you've also said that nearly 80% of younger fans are more likely to watch a game if they bet on it. You even said like, oh, it brings, you know, new people to the sport. So what does that tell us about what our future fans are going to be like?
Yeah, I think we have a different gateway to fandom. So we used to talk about how do people become fans? Well, I played the sport. My dad or my mom took me to a sporting event. You know, if fandom's a part of my family. So you sort of had like identity. I was a fan. My identity is a part of it. But now it's financial. And mm-hmm. So it's a whole different type. I tell the story of my mother-in-law, who is a horse racing fan. And every year makes us watch the Kentucky Derby. We all have to pick a horse in our family group. But it really livens up the group chat. I normally wouldn't watch the Kentucky Derby, but now I've got a horse that I want to win the bragging rights in the family chat for the next year. And so it brings us together in a social way. So there are different things we have to think about in fandom. We have a different type of fan coming to the game, but we also have people socializing around sport that has to do also with betting. So it's not like I want to say it's a full upside, but it's a shift in consumer behavior we have to be aware of.
Okay, so while sport may be attracting new audiences and new forms of engagement, there's also a growing gap between the pace of change and the ability of sport organizations to respond to it. Michael says many organizations are still trying to manage challenges they simply weren't built for.
I think there are things from a fandom perspective that we're overlooking, and frankly, it takes resources to deliver the sport in a unique way. To reach as many people. And for an NSO, we're just trying to figure out how to get the team to Istanbul for the tournament. Like, let's also not overlook the fact that 100% of a national team's revenue probably comes in, 95% comes in Canadian dollars, and in some years, 50% goes out in another currency. So we are also not adjusting as a sector to the realities of uncontrollable variables like currency, like travel cost escalation. But what's happening right now, we're looking for ways to pre-book flights, even though we don't know who's going on them yet, so that we can lock in prices. So these are uncontrollable factors that we aren't well set up to address in the national sport ecosystem, where maybe private sport or pro sport is. They've got a currency hedging account. They've got capital surplus sitting over here to protect them for these rainy day variables that they can't control that very few NSOs have.
Interesting point made by Michael. So Anne, is anyone thinking about what the model of engagement is for sport itself?
I think we can talk about this when we talk about attention spans shifting as well. And I think these two are going to go together. But we have a whole different type of way people are coming to your sport. I think back to the mixed biathlon. What happened there? Why did so many people jump on it and start betting on it? And, you know, thinking, are they going to turn into fans? Did they win in their bet? And are they more likely to follow mixed biathlon than they ever did before? And so you might be expecting to turn them into a valuable fan when they're probably just there much more on a transactional basis.
Right. And I kind of want to loop back to the betting component, because we've talked about people that are betting on sport. And I don't know if you want to talk at all about even the impact on the athletes themselves to bet on sport.
Well, we've had a pretty couple of big scandals. We've had mm-hmm. a professional sport. We've seen it in NBA in Canada. We've seen it in Major League Baseball. We've seen it in MLS now, where players are getting banned. And so what happens there is twofold, I think. One is the players themselves are betting on sport because, again, first of all, they have money. A lot of them have money. They have a lot of idle time between times when they play. And so they start betting on it. And we saw in the United States, the NCAA passed that college athletes can now bet on professional sport. So mm-hmm. where's the slope start? Are they going to, when they start betting on their own sport is when we start getting into trouble, right? This is where then they become vulnerable to people looking for them to point shave, throw parts of the game, whatever the prop bet is, to play a role in that. And that leaves a lot of vulnerability for those athletes because, again, they may have money when they first start gambling. They could end up with a gambling problem, but it also leaves them wide open to particularly these college students who are going to start betting who are athletes. I think there's a lot of slippery slopes we've just really started to teeter onto, and it would be interesting in a not great way to see how far people slide down them.
Well, that's where your researcher comes in and kind of goes, oh, how is this going to play out? Not wanting the detrimental component of that to happen to any of these kids. But like you said, I think it's a really slippery slope. And so on the flip side, and we talked about it in the last episode, there's a powerful Buy Canadian movement. How big of an opportunity is that for sport right now?
Yeah, I mean, I just was looking again to see where are we at with our relationship with the United States. And Angus Reid just did another recent poll that shows tracked it from 2002 in their poll to 2026. And we are by far at the worst situation where Canadians, 76% of Canadians do not think favorably of the United States. And just like 5 years ago, we were like 50-50 on that. And so we've got this real animosity towards the United States, who is tariffing our products, who is starting wars around the world and destabilizing our economy in the process. So I think it's a real opportunity because it's not going away. We have, if things stay true, at least a couple more years of the current administration in the United States doesn't show any signs of slowing down in terms of the volatility nor their animosity towards other countries. So I think it's a real opportunity. It's a real opportunity for Canadian businesses who are taking on the market, but it's also a real opportunity for those businesses to look to engage with Canadians through sport. And so I think that's really, to me, it's still a really big opportunity and it's playing out every day.
Are there any sport organizations right now that are looking more and as and being successful at looking at a national lens for commercial opportunity?
Yeah, I think that we're seeing new partners getting signed. We saw some new ones right before the Olympic Paralympic Games get signed at the top levels. I think at the lower levels of sport, even at the NSOs, I think they're all trying to renew their partners. The difficulty probably is the uncertainty in our markets, right? So if you're going back to your traditional Canadian partners, they're probably maybe experiencing a little bit more of the flux, right? So certainly the automobile category, tough one to get sponsorships right now because we don't know
because
what's happening.
Of the sector,
with, yeah, we don't know what's happening in the sector, right? But let's start thinking about other things that are Canadian. You know, there's solar companies. There are, I don't know, you just open up your Instagram and all you do is get Canadian ads these days,
true,
right?
Yeah.
And so there are tons of companies. There are bed companies and there are, I don't know, shoe companies that people are turning to purchase from and thinking about how do you approach them and make a partnership with them around sport because some of them will be a really good fit for sport. And they probably haven't either been in the sponsorship world or haven't really thought about that. So a way to sort of fully connect themselves to the Canadian market right now.
So from a leadership perspective, how are organizations actually adapting to these new commercial realities, or are they at all?
Well, I think in our sports system, we have to give some grace to the leaders who've been through the last 5 to 8 years. So we've had a sports sector that's navigated a global pandemic, that's navigated decades plus of stable status quo funding while costs have been going up. And I would love to say that they should all be taking advantage of this, but the reality is many of them are looking at tomorrow and keeping the doors open, the lights on, the kids on the pitch, and they don't have the same resource capacity to constantly be looking for new revenue sources, even though they need it, right? I think some have been doing a good job. I think other organizations are really still looking at how do I keep my sport moving forward and hoping that the federal government's going to come with some increased funding for them.
So if we look at system readiness and risk, like your data shows organizations feel highly exposed, like you said, but not very prepared. So why is there such a gap there?
Well, I think that they know they're exposed. I think they're all competing with each other. When I asked the questions to them last year when we did the survey, I said, where do you feel exposed? And so a big number of them felt exposed around corporate partners, which we're talking about. And then I said, where's your biggest threats? Increased competition for those same corporate partners, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody goes to the Petro-Canadas, like we talked about, and they're trying to go to the big names that have always been attached to sport to increase either what they already get or get new money from them. So there is a huge gap that way because I think we've been doing things the same way we've always done things. And then the second part is, when you haven't had increased funding and you've had status quo and costs have gone up, it's not like you're hiring new resources to support you in building out new business revenue streams. A lot of it sits on a CEO or an executive director desk. And oftentimes it's like on the corner of their desk because they're over here trying to keep the athletes moving to a competition. So I give them grace saying that while there is a huge gap, I understand that that has to do with what the day-to-day realities of their job is. And the only way we're going to be able to support that is through increased resources, but also these organizations need to start to work together and start sharing costs, start thinking about ways of building new models to manage sport in Canada.
And so overall, would you say there's a particular set of capabilities missing right now? And if so, what are they?
I'd like to say most of the leaders I've met with have really are awesome. I think the majority of them have moved away. While they may have been an athlete or they have a background in sport, the majority of them are taking advantage of opportunities to further their education. Many of them are doing that if they come from the traditional sport background. We're also seeing leaders come into sport from outside sport. And so they're bringing a new set of skills with them. So I do think the skills are there. I think it's time. Time is our biggest problem for these individuals, right? Like they spend so much of their time dedicated to just keeping their organization running. So, and many of them are really good strategic thinkers. They just don't have the space to do that in. And maybe not necessarily, I would say, the right boards for some organizations. We need to, we've started to change some of the boards. We've moved from operational to skills matrix or skills-based boards. So that's helping. But I see a range of skills on boards when I stand in front of them and talk to them. And I think that we're starting to professionalize the sport system in Canada. These nonprofits are getting more professionalized in terms of running like a business, and our boards need to be the same and keep up with them.
Well, and like you said, the CEOs or the executive directors, I feel like there's a multiple sets of hats that they now have to wear. It's not just one hat, right? Yeah. And that just, I mean, that's just even going from business to strategy, forget about like also the safe sports side and everything else.
I was just going to say, and they might think they have a strategy and then the next thing, something else pops up and it's now you have to pay attention and spend your efforts on safe sport. Now you have to be inclusive. And I'm not saying all those are wrong. Those are absolutely should be fundamental pillars of our system, but all we keep doing with them is adding. We're not really taking anything away, right? So that, like you said, they have two hats, they have four hats, they have five. We're not taking one away. They just get more layered on. Yeah,
that's right. And so, I mean, it's great that you have such an overview of people in the sector. So speaking maybe of the smaller component, if sport is becoming more business oriented, and it sounds like it is, what does that mean for leaders who didn't come up through, say, a commercial lens or have that ability to look at the strategy outside of just keeping the lights on and moving things forward?
Yeah, I think this is the place that the sports sector needs to support each other. We need to build networks that support, that say, hey, I'm new into this, I need support, who can I call? And I hear this story. I do hear the stories when I talk to some of them where they do have, I can lean on so-and-so and ask them. I can run my idea by them. And so in some ways, while they're competing with each other, they're also supporting each other. And I think the system is too, well, I think it's big in some ways, it's also too small to not help each other. And so thinking about building communities of practice and networks that will support each other, exchange knowledge. Often when I talk to them, you know, they get together once a year at these caucus meetings in the spring and they have great discussions, but then they go back to the day-to-day of their job when they leave that environment. And they're saying like, how do I keep this moving forward? We're all trying to add it on the side of our desk. But I think there's a big willingness for them to come together as a coalition and build sort of like a coalition of the willing to support each other and start thinking about how they can start to build joint things together that make their jobs easier.
So I think you answered my next question, but you can tell me if I'm wrong, which is, you know, if there was one mindset shift leaders needed to make immediately, what would that be?
So there's sort of the way I preface this is like, while we're all in an environment together, right? We're all organizations. Every organization has an external environment that it works in. And it looks at the organizations that are in that environment with them often as competition. I think they need to start looking at them as collaborators and thinking about how they can all work together. And I think the big message that came out for me on a regular basis every time I did this talk this year was talking about being the agent of change and not the object of it. And there's an opportunity for all of you, if you take action, to be the agent of the change you want to see, because change is coming to the sports system and it's better to be pushing for it rather than having it pushed on you.
Okay, fair enough. And while organizations are being pushed to evolve commercially, Michael believes the broader structure of sport in Canada may also need to evolve alongside it. One area of focus is sport hosting in the country.
Bringing the world to Canada rather than us traveling the world to go play our sport makes a ton of sense. It's an economic driver. It's actually a cost mitigator for national sport organizations, if not a revenue generating opportunity, when you can host, and if you're backstopped by proper support from government and the ISSC funding, you can host and potentially even make a profit off of hosting, which generates operating return for you in your P&L cycle. So all of that, I think, is something that we can't overlook. There's a lot of time and energy being spent to make the case for why core funding should go up. Just as much time and energy needs to be spent on the increase in ISSC, because that will help mature national sport organizations become more mature. And then maybe from that maturity, we need to think about redirecting CORE to those that simply just need support to keep the lights on and keep moving and don't have hosting capacity. Maybe you start to create, and I laugh, like you can't say two-tier in Canada without somebody raising an eyebrow, but maybe it's time to think about a two-tier system where there's revenue generating, revenue capacity sports that have hosting bandwidth that they can use that to generate an operating return. And then there's those that aren't. But those that aren't get a bigger share of the CORE pie as a result of it, potentially.
Okay, well, not surprisingly, this has been a great conversation that's brought forward a lot of food for thought when it comes to money, risk, and potential new markets in the sports sector in Canada. And so that's a wrap for episode 2. My thanks again to Dr. Ann Pegoraro from the University of Guelph and Canada Basketball CEO Michael Bartlett for joining me. Today's conversation shows just how quickly the economics of sport are changing. I'm Paula Baker, and this has been the Sport Intelligence Podcast brought to you by CIRC. In our next episode, we shift from money to attention, looking at how fans are consuming sport differently, how media habits are changing, and what that means for the future of sport itself. And so if you have any questions or comments, don't hesitate to reach out to us on LinkedIn or at CIRC_Canada on Instagram. Thanks for listening.